Chapter 6. Lorna. It's raining heavily, and Lorna curses under her breath as her umbrella spoke suddenly springs free of the fabric so that it concertinas over her head, no longer providing adequate cover for her freshly cut hair. And now her hair, which took the stylist, the strapping Marco, forever to blow dry into a sleek finish, will fluff out to resemble the shape of a bell. She'd wanted to look nice for Alberto, make an effort for their date tonight. After nearly 2 years together, she fears things have become stale between them. She works during the day while he's out late supervising the bar he owns. She can just imagine him flirting with the young women, pretending he's Tom Cruise from Cocktail. Why, oh why, does she always choose the wrong men? Too young, too handsome, too egotistical. She'll be 41 in 3 months' time. She should know better. But no, she won't think negatively. That's not her style. And anyway, he's promised to take the night off from the bar so they can go dancing. Maybe they can get some of their fire back. She's only wearing a light linen blazer over the boring hotel uniform, off-white blouse and dark green knee-length skirt, although she's paired it with a bubblegum pink scarf, as it was hot when she left her apartment this morning. Her wedges are rubbing her heels. By the time she makes the 10-minute walk back to the apartment she shares with Alberto, she'll be drenched. But she keeps up her stride across the busy plaza, trying to ignore the scraping of flesh on her heel. She dares not stop, or someone will careen into the back of her. Not that she's complaining. She loves the hustle and bustle of San Sebastian. The sea is rough today. Angry white waves roll towards the shore, and some fool is surfing in the froth. Despite the bad weather, a group of holidaymakers are perched on the beach, determined not to let the showers put them off. It's been a hard day at work. The hotel where she's a receptionist has started to get busy, as it always does at this time of year. They've had quite a few families from the UK this week, some of whom have complained about the weather, not expecting to leave an early May heatwave in England for spring showers in Spain. She'd pointed them in the direction of the indoor aquarium. She understood their disappointment. They'd come on holiday for the sun and the beach and the outside tapas restaurants. She'd felt the same when she first moved here, surprised that it does indeed rain in Spain. But she loves it here, loves their little apartment with its own courtyard in a beautiful old building off a cobbled street in the old town. And the food. She could eat paella and prawns and squid, not to mention the pinchos, every day. She touches the ends of her wet hair. All afternoon, while sitting behind her desk watching the hotel residents come into the lobby, drenched and disappointed, she'd been looking forward to getting her hair done. And now it's ruined. After another 5 minutes' walk through a maze of crowded streets and tall stone-coloured buildings, with their black wrought-iron balconies rearing up at either side of her, she's reached her apartment. She lets herself through the enormous front door into the lobby. She continues down the long, thin hallway, passing the glass lift that goes up to the second floor, and enters through another door at the end of the corridor. It leads across an open-air courtyard to two maisonettes perpendicular to each other, hers and Marie's. You'd never know from looking at the front of her building that all this was hidden behind. Marie, a petite woman in her late 50s with waist-length dark hair, is standing at her threshold, banging dust from a rug.
Buenas noches,
she calls, as Lorna walks carefully across the courtyard so as not to slip on the rain-slicked terracotta tiles. Lorna smiles and waves back, aware that she must look like a drowned rat. She lets herself into her own front door. It leads straight into the dining living area, with wooden stairs that go up to a mezzanine level where the ensuite bedroom is. The kitchen and cloakroom are at the rear of the apartment, looking out onto the backs of buildings, where there is also a concrete basketball court covered with graffiti. Sometimes she can hear the local kids playing out there, or listening to music late at night. It's comforting, makes her feel she is not alone, while Alberto is working. She peels off her wet blazer and kicks off her shoes, bending over to examine her heel where a blister has formed. She pads into the galley kitchen to put the kettle on. She's tempted by the bottle of white wine she has in the fridge, but decides against it. Later, she can let her hair down in a way she hasn't for ages. She leans against the counter while she waits for the kettle to boil and checks her watch. It's nearly 6. She should have enough time to straighten her hair before Alberto gets home. He promised to be back by 7. She notices 2 wine glasses in the sink. She was sure she washed up before she went to work this morning. She never leaves a mess. The kitchen's too small for that. It would make her feel stressed to see it cluttered. She'd left Alberto in bed, one tanned arm flung across his face this morning. He wasn't due at the bar until 4 p.m., he'd said. So what had he been doing all day? And, more importantly, with whom? She picks up the wine glasses and examines them for lipstick marks. There is nothing, and she replaces them in the sink. She's being ridiculous, she decides. This is where madness lies. She's not normally like this. She's usually trusting. Too trusting, as it turns out. Her last boyfriend, Sven, had left her for someone else after 18 months together. She'd been living in Amsterdam then, had left England when Safi met Tom. After she broke up with Sven, she didn't want to stay, and had decided to find a place in Spain instead. Within months, she'd met and fallen in love with Alberto. Tall, ripped, tanned Alberto, 6 years her junior. She thought she'd feel younger, but it has the opposite effect. Her mobile vibrates on the worktop, and she leans across to get it. Safi's name flashes up on screen, and Lorna feels a lurch of happiness, followed by a quick stab of guilt. She hasn't seen her daughter since Christmas, and she misses her. "Hi, honey," she says into the phone.
"Mum."
Safi sounds hesitant, and straight away Lorna's antennae twitch. She stands up, picturing her daughter's beautiful and slightly anxious face. "Is everything okay?"
"Yes. Well, no. Something odd has happened."
No small talk. She loves that about her daughter. She always gets straight to the point. "Okay?" Lorna braces herself for the many catastrophes she tries not to worry about befalling her only child while she's living so far away. Her stomach tenses. The line crackles, and Lorna moves into the living room as Safi speaks. Did she just say something about dead bodies?
10 days ago, in the garden, while the builders were digging.
She sounds young. Lorna sinks into her lime green armchair, her mobile still pinned to her ear, her stomach dropping. "What?" Her mouth falls open as her daughter fills her in. And why is she only hearing about this now? Safi said this happened 10 days ago.
"The police are going to want to speak to Gran, although I haven't heard anything about it yet. Do you know the exact date she bought the cottage? I know Gran told us it was sometime in the 1970s, but she might have got it wrong."
Lorna tucks her legs underneath her. The rain has soaked through to her blouse, and she feels cold and damp. I have no idea. I didn't even know about Skelton Place until she told us about it last year. As far as I know, she never lived there herself.
You've got the deeds, haven't you? It should say on there when Gran bought it.
Lorna frowns. I have them somewhere, yes. I'll dig them out. But the police might already have this information.
Even so, I'd like to know. And the list of tenants.
You might be better off speaking to her solicitor. I'll see if I have their details. Safi shouldn't have to be dealing with this alone. Lorna knows how close she is to her gran. They share a bond that Lorna never had with her mother. She loves her, of course, but they've always been so different. Her mum kept herself to herself, never wanting to socialise or get involved. And as a result, Lorna found herself rebelling at a young age, drinking and partying at 14, pregnant at 15. Her mum had called her a wild child, resignedly, sadly. Safi was the greatest gift Lorna could have bestowed upon her to make up for it. A quiet, studious daughter who preferred staying in on a Saturday night to going out partying. It had warmed her heart to see how much they loved each other. And it had broken it, mostly for Safi, when her mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I'll come to England, Lorna says suddenly. Can I stay with you at the cottage? I'd love to see it.
Coming over, but you don't have to. There's no need.
Lorna swallows her disappointment. I want to see you. I miss you. And I haven't seen Mum for a while either. And I can help you sort things out.
Mum, I don't think it's as easy as that.
I know, but I'd like to be there. Especially if the police are sniffing around, asking questions and disrupting you. I'm happy to stay in a hotel.
No, it's not that. Of course you can stay here. We have a futon.
A pause.
Will you be bringing Alberto?
Lorna thinks about the two wine glasses in the sink and leans back against the chair's soft cushions. No, we could do with some time apart, to be honest.
Oh, Mum.
It's okay, things are fine. We're off out tonight, but he's busy with the bar. She lets her words hang in the air. Her daughter is smart and more sensible than she ever was at that age. She won't be fooled. When had their roles reversed? It should be Safi ringing her about boyfriend troubles. Instead, she's been with Tom for 4 years, when Lorna can barely keep a relationship with a man for 4 minutes. What are you up to tonight? Her daughter laughs, totally unselfconsciously.
The usual. Staying in with a takeaway and watching Netflix.
Lorna smiles into the phone. She suddenly longs to be there, with her daughter, eating fish and chips off plates on their laps and watching a box set. I'll fly home Saturday morning. Is that okay?
I'll pick you up at Bristol Airport. Just text me when you know times.
They say goodbye, and Lorna climbs the wooden stairs to her bedroom, to change into a slinky red dress that she knows is Alberto's favourite. He calls it her Jessica Rabbit dress because it accentuates her bust. As she tries to fix the damage to her hair, she mulls over the conversation with her daughter. Two bodies buried in the garden. A man and a woman. A memory, hazy and warped, flits through her mind. A flash of a garden, darkness punctuated by fireworks exploding into the night sky. But before she can grasp hold of it, it floats away, like the seeds of a dandelion on the breeze, out of reach. Chapter 7. Safi. I spot Mum straight away. She's striding through arrivals at Bristol Airport in an unnecessarily large floppy straw hat and pink cropped jeans that show off all her curves. She has a wrist full of bangles and huge dangly earrings that catch the light when she moves. She looks like a chandelier. Men stare at my mother. It used to embarrass me when I was younger. Mum's exuberance, her naturally flirty nature and cleavage that was always on display. Plus, she was so much younger than the other mums at the school gates. But not now. The two of us living in different countries has made me realise how much I miss her. I wonder if it's because I'm about to become a mother myself. I'm not sure how Mum will feel about being a gran at 41. Will it make her feel old? I swallow my worries. I can't be thinking about that now. I've got too much else on my mind. Like the phone call yesterday evening from the detective. When Mum spots me, a wide smile lights up her whole face and she click-clacks towards me in her heeled sandals, pulling a leopard print suitcase behind her.
Honey!
She cries, wrapping me into a hug. She smells familiar, of Tom Ford perfume and coconut sun cream. It's so lovely to see you. You too. Looking well, Mum? Mum holds me at arm's length to assess me.
So do you,
she says, and I have to laugh to myself at the surprise in her voice.
You look like you've filled out a bit. It suits you. You know I think you're too skinny.
And then she looks around.
Where's Tom?
He's waiting by the car with Snowy. She links arms with me.
It'll be so lovely to see him. Now, tell me about these skeletons. It all sounds so unbelievable, doesn't it?
I open my mouth to speak, but Mum continues.
I mean, as long as the police don't go charging in there, upsetting your gran with lots of questions, let me know the name of the police officer you're dealing with, and I'll find out exactly what they're planning to do.
I can feel a headache coming on. I love her to bits, but my God, she never stops talking. I let her natter on as we walk to the car. Tom is leaning against the Mini, a bemused smile on his face that he always seems to adopt whenever Mum is around. Snowy is sniffing the ground by his feet.
Tom!
Mum exclaims, running over to him and enveloping him, her jangle of bracelets almost catching his ear. He glances over her shoulder at me with raised eyebrows, and I stifle a laugh.
Lovely to see you. Good flight, he says, removing himself from her embrace.
She waves a hand dismissively.
Cramped. I was squashed between two very large people, but...
She shrugs.
I'm here now. And I have to say the weather is nicer than it is in San Sebastian at the moment.
I watch as Mum climbs inelegantly into the back seat, while Tom takes her suitcase and puts it into the boot. We've said, with the baby coming, we should really change the car to a four-door. But with the extension, money is tight.
I'm excited about seeing the cottage,
Mum says, sitting forward and holding onto the back of Tom's seat as I drive out of the car park.
After I spoke to you on the phone, I found the deeds and gave the solicitor a quick ring.
Of course she did. I bet Mum was onto it the minute I ended our call. But I'm grateful I didn't have to do it.
Apparently your gran bought the cottage back in March 1977, and she lived there until she rented it out in spring 1981. Then she bought the house in Bristol.
She says all this without pausing for breath.
So you would have lived in the cottage for a bit? I ask, surprised. Can you remember it?
No, not really. I would have been 3 when we left, but maybe seeing it again will jog my memory. Well, it's a bit old-fashioned inside, I explain, especially the kitchen, although Tom's making excellent progress on the rest. I flash Tom a smile. Unfortunately, the spare room still has bright yellow walls.
Mum laughs. That will suit me down to the ground. So, tell me more about your gran.
I glance at Mum in the rearview mirror. She's taken her hat off, and her dark brown eyes are bright with excitement. But there's something else, too, a pain that she's trying to hide. I wonder what's really going on with her and Alberto. I always get the sense that my mother is running away. I open my mouth to speak, hoping I'm not interrupted this time. I had a call from a detective last night, a DS Matthew Barnes. He sounded nice enough, but he said he's spoken to the manager of the care home, Joy. She advised the police that it would be better for Gran to be interviewed at Elmbrook, a place where she feels safe, and that either you or I should be there too. They deem that she's able enough mentally to be interviewed because she has some lucid moments and seems to remember a lot from the past, so it might be helpful. I'll come too, she insists. Okay, great. How long are you planning on staying? What about work? Mum makes a foot noise through her mouth. I've taken a week off. I think this would be classed as extenuating circumstances, don't you? Well, yes, but it's only a formality. They have to speak to everyone who occupied the property during those 20 years. I know, but it would be lovely to spend some time with you, honey. I haven't seen you properly since Christmas. And what a nightmare that was, I think. And to be fair, it wasn't Mum's fault. It was more that moron she calls a boyfriend, who is rude, dismissive, and acted like he'd rather be anywhere else, preferably on a beach in Spain, than spending the day in our tiny flat in Croydon. And in the past, when I've spent time with Mum, she always gives me the impression she can't wait to go back to her hectic life. Out of the corner of my eye, Tom is staring straight ahead with a keep me out of it expression on his face. I turn onto the long Ashton bypass. There's nothing I can say. And it's not like I don't want to spend time with Mum. But at the moment, I just don't have the energy for her, well, energy. She never says it. She doesn't have to. But I know she disapproves that I've settled down so early. When Tom and I moved in together a few years ago, she tried to talk me out of it. And when I told her we were saving for a deposit to buy a house, she warned me about tying myself to a mortgage too young. It's obvious that having me at 16 had ruined her teenage years. Something she certainly seems to be making up for now, judging by her Facebook photos. You can stay as long as you want, I say, trying to ignore the dragging feeling in the pit of my stomach. 40 minutes later, we've arrived in Beggar's Nook. Mum draws breath for long enough to gaze out of the window at the Cotswold stone buildings. What a stunning place. Strange name, kind of eerie. I don't know, though, it's familiar, but that could be because it reminds me of those pretty villages in Agatha Raisin. How far away is the nearest town? I mentally roll my eyes. Trust her. She's probably already planning a day out shopping. This village will be too remote for her. Chippenham, 7 or 8 miles away. 8 miles? Wow. She glances around with a slightly panicked look in her eyes, like a pony that's on the verge of bolting. We head through the centre of the village, and as we pass the main square, she gasps. What's that? She says, pointing to a cube-shaped stone construction with open sides and a roof with a spire on top. It sits to the edge of the square, where the three main streets converge, and in front of the church. It's a very striking landmark, with stone steps surrounding all four sides. That's the Market Cross, says Tom, his face lighting up at his chance to be able to impart a fact. I looked it up when we first moved here. It dates back to the 14th century. They're quite common in market towns and villages, apparently, although I've never seen one as lovely as this. Mum is frowning at it. I remember this. Really? She blinks.
It's very hazy. But I've seen it before. She shakes her head. It's so frustrating, but it's like the image is there, in my mind, very briefly, and a feeling. She places a hand on her heart, and I can see, from my rearview mirror, that she's closed her eyes. This feeling... Her eyes snap open, but then it's gone.
I read once, says Tom, that our memories are forever evolving, so we only remember the version of the memory we last recalled, rather than the original event.
I roll my eyes and laugh. But Mum remains unusually stony-faced, her nose pressed up to the glass, like an expectant but slightly hesitant child. I glance at Tom, and he shrugs. I continue up the hill until we reach the rank of 12 properties that's known as Skelton Place. I pull on to the shingle driveway, which fans out to greet us, relieved that there aren't any journalists hanging around today. It's been 2 weeks since the bodies were discovered, so I'm hoping they've now moved on to another story.
Gosh, the woods are quite bleak, aren't they? Says Mum. They encompass the whole village. I feel like I'm in Little Red Riding Hood.
They can be, especially on a dull day, I say.
I'm surprised the cottages don't have names, says Mum. Look at all that beautiful wisteria and the thatched roof. Nine Skelton Place is so... I don't know.
She gives a small shudder.
Sinister sounding.
I know what she means, even though it niggles me that she's finding fault with everything. It's not exactly a pretty name. It doesn't seem to go with our little property. The cottage isn't very big, and it wouldn't have been worth as much as Gran's house in Bristol. But I've never lived anywhere so beautiful, so quaint, and postcard perfect. The wisteria is out in full force at the moment, and wraps around the front of the house like a dusky lilac feather boa. And from the driveway, you can't see the massive hole in the back garden. By rights, it should be Mum who's living here, with whatever toy boy has taken her fancy this time, not me and Tom. I'd offered to pay Mum some money from our savings. She refused. As far as I'm aware, Mum doesn't own another property. She rented the flat where I grew up in Bromley, Kent. She said she didn't like being tied down, but to me, it always seemed a little irresponsible. We still haven't got around to transferring the deeds into my and Tom's names. I'd been meaning to broach the subject with Mum before we started work on the kitchen extension, but I haven't quite managed it yet. Just like I haven't quite managed to bring up the subject of my pregnancy. I'm aware it's a running theme. I step out of the car and stretch. My back aches, and I feel nauseous. I take in deep lungfuls of country air as Mum and Tom climb out, Mum giggling as her heel gets tangled in the seatbelt, and Tom laughing along as he helps her. Tom is so good with people, so patient. I know he'll make an excellent father.
It's a bit pongy around here, she says as she steps onto the driveway. Is that manure?
I grimace at Tom. As I walk around the car to join them, I see someone hovering by the hedge at the end of our driveway. I freeze. It's that man again. The one I saw the other day lurking by the cottage, and the one I'm sure I saw driving past Gran's care home.
Tom, that man,
I begin, but Tom has noticed him too. He hands Snowy over to Mum.
Bloody journalists, he mutters under his breath.
Why are they still hanging around when the police have no new information? I cry. The police haven't released the information about the cracked skull yet.
Oi!
He shouts, stepping forward. But the man disappears behind the hedge. I watch as Tom darts down the driveway in pursuit.
Hey! Wait!
When he reaches the entrance, he stops, looks back at us, and shrugs.
He's gone.
Chapter 8. Lorna. Lorna watches as Tom hurries towards them. When he reaches Safi, he drapes an arm protectively around her shoulders, and she feels a pang of envy at the bond they obviously share. It was the same with her and Ewan once. But having a baby when they were both still kids themselves took its toll on their relationship. Safi looks cute in her oversized dungarees, biting her lip. She was always doing that as a kid. Lorna was forever telling her to stop.
That was weird,
Tom says, sounding out of breath.
He must be a journalist, but why run away when I confronted him? Why not ask us questions?
Lorna hands him the dog lead with relief. She's never had an affinity with animals. Safi's face is pinched with concern.
I've seen him before, the other day, she says.
She already knows her daughter will be making more of this, her imagination running wild. Her little warrior. When she was 4, she got it into her head that a monster or dragon could get into their flat, and Lorna had sat on the edge of Safi's bed every night for a few months, convincing her it wasn't possible.
Honey, it will just be another reporter, she says, squeezing Safi's upper arm gently. It's only to be expected. Come on, I'm excited about seeing inside this cottage.
Safi glances back towards the road, her big brown eyes darting about like a scared puppy's. But then she turns to Lorna, her mouth in a tight line, and nods. Tom lets them in through the arched front door and into a small hallway with beams overhead and stripped floorboards. He stands back to allow them over the threshold first. She notices that Tom's head is only inches away from the beams. He has a proud look on his face, and she remembers Safi's words in the car.
It looks gorgeous, Tom, she says, glancing around at the Farrowin ball-painted walls and the sanded floorboards. So the living room's through there, says Safi, pointing to a wooden door to their left. And at the end of the hallway is the kitchen. It's small, but there's room for a table, just about, and... But Lorna has turned instinctively to her right, to the room just before the stairs. She pushes the door open, and a flash of memory explodes in her mind. A sewing machine, the sound of a pedal, the clack, clack, clack. She blinks rapidly. When her vision clears, she can see there is no sewing machine, just a desk and a computer under the window, the walls decorated with ugly brown and yellow old-fashioned paper.
My study, says Safi, from behind her. We haven't got around to decorating it yet. I don't think this wallpaper has been changed in 50 years. Lorna turns back to her daughter, a smile plastered to her face. A sewing machine. Her mother never had one in the Bristol house.
It's cute, she says. It'll look lovely when it's painted.
Safi throws her an uncertain smile, as though sensing something has unnerved Lorna. And then, upstairs, she indicates the staircase, bare boards. Were they like that before? There are 3 bedrooms, the master bedroom at the front, then a small double and a single overlooking the back garden where we'll put the bait. She stops, a horrified expression crossing her face.
The what? Were you?
It suddenly dawns on Lorna. The roundness to Safi's face, the slight weight gain.
Were you about to say baby?
Safi's cheeks turn fuchsia and she nods, looking guilty.
Yes. I'm pregnant.
Lorna reels. Pregnant? Shit. She's still so young, still her baby. Lorna feels a thud of disappointment. Safi's only 24 and has barely lived. Has she learnt nothing from Lorna? She was always telling her to wait until she was older and had her career established before marriage and kids.
Wow, that's wonderful news, honey,
she manages to say, swallowing her true feelings.
Congratulations.
She wraps her daughter in a hug, although Safi feels tense in her arms. Is she that unconvincing? She pulls away to address Tom, who's standing awkwardly by the front door, still clutching her suitcase, Snowy sitting at his feet, his head cocked to one side, looking up at her.
You too, Tom. Wow.
She turns back to her daughter.
How far along? Have you had the 3-month scan yet?
Safi nods, a blush creeping down her neck and towards her blue and white striped t-shirt.
Yes, I'm 17 weeks now. The baby's due on the 13th of October. 17 weeks?
It means Safi would have known for a good 2, perhaps even 3 months. Lorna can't help but feel hurt that she hadn't come to her straight away. Lorna had hidden it from her own mum, of course, but that was because she'd been not quite 16 when she'd found out, Ewan only a year older. Lorna had been 5 months gone before Rose had noticed. The wild child, only daughter of quiet, straight-laced Rose Grey, had done what the neighbours had been predicting for years, got herself knocked up when she was still in school. Everyone called her pram face. Not that Lorna regretted any of it. She might have split with Ewan when Safi was only 5. But they'd made a good go of it, moving in together, getting married, though divorced, a few years later. But he'd remained a big part of Safi's life. She'd spent every other weekend with him in his little London pad when she was growing up. And Lorna knows the two of them remain close. Neither Lorna nor Ewan ever remarried. And Lorna kept his surname. Lorna had envisaged the day she'd become a grandmother. She knew she wouldn't be old, because she'd been such a young mother. But she'd expected to be older than 40-sodding-1. What will Alberto think? This all goes through her mind at speed, and then she pulls herself up. She's being selfish. This isn't about her. It's about Safi and Tom and their baby.
I'm so pleased for you, honey. Truly I am.
Safi seems to sag with relief. It wasn't planned, but... She lets out a nervous laugh.
Well, you know.
Lorna laughs too.
I do. Have you told your dad?
Not yet. I wanted to tell you first. She tries not to feel gleeful, but at least she knows before Ewan.
Well, come on then. Let's get the kettle on and then you can show me where the bodies were buried.
A sentence I never thought I'd say. Tom announces he's going to walk Snowy around the block to give them time to catch up and disappears out of the front door. Why does she have the feeling he can't wait to get away? Although Lorna feels relieved she's got her daughter to herself for a bit. The kitchen is small and old-fashioned, and as soon as Lorna walks in, she heads straight for the window. Through the glass, she can see the mess in the garden, the abandoned digger, the dug-up patio slabs, the huge hole in the ground, and the dense woods, a brooding backdrop. It gives her the heebie-jeebies. She senses Safi at her shoulder, but she doesn't turn. It feels as though someone is gently blowing on the back of her neck, and she shudders. At the end of the garden, just before the woods, there is a large tree with purple flowers and a thick branch that looks like an arm reaching towards the house. She takes a sharp breath.
What is it, Mum? Safi asks. That tree.
She shakes her head. The purple petals. She used to put them in her bucket and mash them with water. She remembers that.
I played in that garden, says Lorna. It's very familiar to me. I think I think the tree might even have had a rope swing once. I used to pretend to make perfume with its flowers.
She feels Safi's warm hand squeezing her shoulder.
Wow, Mum.
Lorna turns to her daughter.
Are you happy to stay here, knowing this happened?
Safi looks pale and a little tearful.
We haven't got anywhere else to go. And before this, I loved it here.
Lorna swallows the sudden lump in her throat.
I know. And it happened a long time ago, didn't it? Not as long ago as I was hoping.
She flashes a watery smile. Then her eyes go to the window.
I wonder who they were.
Maybe the police will find out through dental records.
Can we go outside?
I'd like to take a closer look.
Now the police have finished, we can. I'll grab the back door key. Hold on a sec.
Safi moves slowly, her shoulders hunched, and Lorna longs to wrap her in a cuddle.
Here we go.
Safi is back, and Lorna moves out of the way so she can open the stable door. They venture into the garden together. The sun is going down now, and the trees cast shadows on the lawn. They make their way over the uneven ground to the gaping hole. It's very deep, and as they get closer, Lorna can smell the damp soil. The police have checked there are no more bodies, she asks. She feels like she does when she occasionally visits a graveyard, aware of all those corpses below her feet, even though she knows these bodies have been taken away. Safi nods. They had special dogs here. There are no more, don't worry. Lorna places her arm around Safi's shoulders.
Come on, let's have that cup of tea, and then you can show me my room.
Later, after Tom comes back with Snowy, and they cluster around the little wooden table in the kitchen for dinner, Safi pulls it out from the wall so there's room for Lorna. She broaches the subject of the baby again.
So, have you thought of any names yet?
Not really,
says Safi, through a mouthful of bolognese. Will you find out the sex? Safi glances across at Tom.
No. We want it to be a surprise.
You do, says Tom, good-naturedly. I wouldn't mind finding out.
I just think it will be a nice surprise.
But if we find out, we'll know what colour to paint the nursery.
Safi rolls her eyes. Ever the practical one, she says fondly. We can paint it a pale grey. Lorna tries not to grimace. What is it with grey? What happened to colour? Safi reaches across the table, takes Tom's hand, and squeezes it. Her daughter is more like her dad when it comes to being demonstrative, but the love she has for this man shines from her. It slams home even harder what Lorna is missing with Alberto. In fact, with any of the men in her past, apart from maybe Ewan, but they'd been so young. Safi puts down her knife and fork, a glazed look in her eyes.
I keep thinking about Gran. She should be here, with us.
I know, honey, Lorna says gently. Her daughter's eyes well.
Do you think she's happy in that place? I worry that she's unhappy and doesn't understand why she's there, that she has moments when she's scared. Do you think we could bring her here to visit?
It might confuse her, and she's well looked after there. It's a good care home. I did my research. Safi has always lived too close to the well, as Lorna used to put it. She was such a sensitive kid. Once, on a holiday to Portugal, when she was 9, she burst into tears at a restaurant when she saw the lobsters in a tank ready to be eaten. It took her days to get over it. She'd worry for hours about a homeless man on the street or a stray dog.
But it's not her home, is it?
Being here must remind you of her. Safi's face crumbles.
It does. And I miss her.
I do too.
Lorna realizes, with a jolt, that this is true. When Safi was born, her mother doted on her only grandchild, and the two of them have always been exceptionally close. Lorna was pleased they loved each other so much, and she tried, she really did, not to mind being the third wheel when they were all together. They were so alike, she could see that. But while her mother let their differences create a wedge between them, Lorna has always vowed never to allow that to happen with Safi. "Why don't you show me where the baby's room is going to be?" Lorna suggests, hoping to cheer Safi up. Safi's face brightens, and she leads Lorna into the hallway and up the stairs. "We're going to get a runner up here, but we can't decide on one. Maybe natural wool," she shrugs. "Or something." At the top of the stairs, they turn into the little bedroom. It's no more than 8 feet by 9, with a fireplace on the left wall. But Lorna can see it would make a perfect nursery. It's empty at the moment, other than a few boxes stacked in the corner. The carpet has been ripped up to expose the floorboards, and the wallpaper is faded. But as soon as Lorna steps into the room, she's overcome with a sense of déjà vu so strong she has to hold on to the windowsill. "What is it?" asks Safi, alarm in her voice. "Are you okay?" "It's just..." Lorna turns towards the window, which overlooks the back garden. She can see the purple tree from here. It only stayed purple in the spring, and then the leaves would turn green, falling off in the winter. It used to carpet the lawn. She turns and reaches out to touch the wallpaper. She remembers. She remembers lying in bed in this very room and trying to decipher face shapes in the rosebuds on the wallpaper. Lorna turns to her daughter. "I think this used to be my bedroom."
Chapter 9. Theo. The grave is looking bare. The yellow roses that Theo placed there last week were already brown and wilted. The hot weather must have speeded up their decay. "Your dad hasn't been again then?" says Jen, at his shoulder, voicing what he's thinking. "Are you surprised?" he asks, trying to keep his voice light. Theo's wife raises her well-groomed eyebrows in answer. She squeezes his arm gently, but doesn't say anything. He knows she doesn't like his father. And why would she, after the way he is with her? But she never badmouths him. She hands him a bouquet of brightly coloured blooms that they bought on the way here. "I'll leave you alone for a bit. You don't have to. I know you like to talk to her." He flashes her a small smile. "You think it's weird?" He told her once, early in their relationship, then instantly regretted it. He didn't want her to think he was some sad mummy's boy. "Of course it's not weird. I just wish I'd had the chance to meet her. She'd have loved you. And she would have. Everyone does." Jen is instantly lovable with her effervescent personality and her warm nature. Straight away, she puts you at ease. His wife reaches up and kisses him. She has to stand on tiptoe. "I'll be over there, reading the old graves." "Now that is weird," he laughs. "Hey, it's interesting." She throws him a smile over her shoulder as she wanders off towards an old cracked tombstone with a huge angel perched on top. He watches her go in her long, swishy summery skirt and tight t-shirt. Her shoulders are pushed back, her walk confident. The knot of strawberry blonde hair on top of her head wobbling as she strides away towards the older part of the cemetery. Then he turns back to his mum's grave. "She's been brave, Mum," he says. "She's still not pregnant, and I know she's worried. We've been trying for nearly a year." He wonders if he'd have been so honest about this stuff if his mum was still alive. He stoops to take the dead roses out of the vase. The fetid smell of the rank water rises up his nostrils and hits the back of his throat. He shoves them into a plastic bag ready for the compost heap and replaces them with a fresh bouquet. Theo visits every Saturday, mostly without Jen, as she's usually working at the beauty salon in town, and only gets one Saturday off a month. And each time, he hopes to see something other than his decaying flowers from the previous week. Something to show his dad had visited, that he actually cares. But for years, there has been nothing. It happened gradually over the first year or two, he supposes, looking back. His dad's lack of interest. He suspects that his dad no longer visits the grave because he finds it too emotional. If he doesn't visit, he can pretend it hasn't happened. Theo kneels down on the dry grass and traces his fingers along the date of the headstone. Wednesday, 12th of May, 2004. Today is the 14th anniversary of her death. How can it be 14 years, he wonders, when it still feels like it happened yesterday? Theo had been away at university in York when he got the phone call that changed his life. He'd been 19, and despite the heat of the day, he shivers when he remembers. His father's deep, commanding voice, thick with emotion at the end of the line.
She's fallen,
he said.
She's fallen down the stairs, and she's dead. I'm sorry, son. I'm so sorry.
Theo had been standing at the student union bar with a group of mates jostling either side of him, the mobile in his hand. Unable to comprehend what his dad was telling him when everyone around him was drinking, jolly and singing.
You need to come home.
He'd taken the bus straight away, thankful that the bender he'd been envisaging had just begun, and he'd had the chance to drink only half a pint. He remembers the journey from York to Harrogate clearly even after all these years. He remembers hoping that his dad was confused and had got it wrong, even though he knew there was nothing wrong with his sharp mind. At the hospital, he'd looked broken, diminished and old. What am I going to do? He'd said over and over again, his face grey. What am I going to do now? Theo never went back to finish his medical degree. Instead, for the remainder of that academic year, he stayed with his dad in the ugly mansion he'd always hated and tried to find memories of his mother in every corner. But all he could see when he closed his eyes at night was the image of her falling down that fucking elaborate oak staircase, then lying crumpled and broken at the bottom. She'd been there all day, apparently, until his father came home from work and found her. His dad said she died instantly. But to this day, Theo doesn't know whether to believe it. He still tortures himself that she lay there on that beeswaxed parquet, in pain, unable to move to get to a phone for help. She died while Theo was busy shagging his first girlfriend in his cramped room in a shared student house in York. That September, he changed his course to catering and hospitality, much to the derision of his dad. But he knew his mum would have been happy for him, would have told him life's too short. The cemetery is quiet, but Theo still lowers his voice as he talks to his mum. He describes the article he found in his dad's study 2 days ago. I think dad is trying to find someone, he says, picking at the grass with his fingers. It feels like straw. He's been unable to stop thinking about it. He'd memorised the two names from the paper, Saffron Cutler and Rose Grey. Find her. But which one? And why? For the years after his mother died, his dad has remained an enigma to Theo, hiding part of himself, refusing to talk about anything important. In those months after her death, the two of them had rattled around in that house, and he thought, naively, he realises now, that they could provide comfort to each other, maybe even become closer. But instead, after that first night at the hospital, and his dad's rare outpouring of emotion, there had been nothing, just silence. His dad had gone back to work after the funeral, leaving Theo to wallow in loneliness and grief. He knew his parents' marriage had been far from perfect. Looking back now, he can see his dad was possessive. The way he demanded his mum to change her outfit if he thought she was wearing something too tarty, as he put it. Theo had never thought his mum looked tarty. Jen would quite rightly slap Theo's face if he ever said anything like that to her. He smiles at the thought of his feisty wife, his little firebomb. But his mum would just sigh good-naturedly, then go and change into something more nun-like to please her husband. She very rarely went anywhere with friends. In fact, I can't remember her having any female friends. His parents would go out to dinner with other couples, older couples from his dad's work, stuffy galas and dinner parties. But his mum never went far without his dad. What she did in the house all day while his dad was at work, he doesn't know. But she never had a job. Once, when he was about 16, he came home from school early to find her crying at a dressing table. Her eyes were all puffy, and he was sure he saw an angry bruise on her shoulder that she hurriedly covered with a cardigan when he walked into her bedroom. When he asked her if she was okay, she said, in a rare moment of honesty, "I feel like a prisoner." And then she'd given him a watery smile and told him she was just being silly, that it was hormones and to ignore her. But it had left Theo with an uneasy feeling for days. He'd watched his parents more closely. They were so unlike how his friends' parents were with each other. "It's just his way, sweetheart. Your father is a brilliant man. He works so hard. He just gets a little stressed sometimes." But he never saw his dad raise a hand to her. If he had, he would have thumped him. "There is so much I wish I could ask you," he says now. "And I promise, if I'm ever lucky enough to be a dad, I won't be emotionally cut off like him." He stands up and dusts off his jeans. "See you next week. I love you, Mum." Then he strolls off to find Jen, who is standing by a huge tombstone dating back 200 years, with about 10 members of the same family inscribed on it. He comes up behind her and wraps his arms around her waist. "All done," he says. "Shall we go get coffee now?" she says, turning to him. She frowns. "What is it? You look worried." "I don't know. Something doesn't feel right. About Dad. About that article." He'd told Jen all about it after his shift that night. "Why don't you just ask him about it?" "My dad isn't like yours. His father-in-law is the polar opposite. Warm, kind, fun, loving." "I know, but if you confront him about this, he can't wriggle out of it." "Theo," she says softly, "you know I love you. But where your dad is concerned, you, I don't know, pussyfoot around him." He laughs. "Pussyfoot?" "Yes, pussyfoot. It's like he's scared of him." "You've met my father?" "Yes, he's formidable, I'm not going to lie." His wife is being diplomatic. Even Jen's effusive and bubbly personality couldn't win his father over. He's never told Jen this, but after he first brought her home, his dad had said she was common. It was the only time Theo had stood up to him after his mum's death. He told him he loved her, and if he ever heard him say or do anything nasty to her, he'd never speak to him again. His dad had looked shocked, then muttered something about it not lasting. But here they were, 5 years later, and married for the last three. "He won't tell me the truth. Dad should have been a politician." "There must be someone you could ask. I know your grandparents are dead, but a cousin, perhaps?" He takes his wife's hand and they walk out of the cemetery together. He doesn't know his cousins. It's hard for Jen to understand because her family is huge and they all get on. "I'll start by asking him. And if he doesn't give me what I want, I'll find out for myself." "Good. And I'll help. It will be a distraction." She smiles, but her eyes are too bright. It feels as if someone is squeezing his heart. "Jen, we could go and see someone. Get some tests." She shakes her head, a blonde curl falling into her eyes. "Not yet. I'm not ready to face that yet. Let's just wait for now." He kisses her hand in response, his mind already slipping back to his father and the newspaper article. "Tomorrow," he vows. "Tomorrow I'll find out what my dad is looking for. And why."
Chapter 10. Lorna. It's too dark and quiet, and Lorna is finding it difficult to sleep on the hard futon, knowing her daughter and her boyfriend are on the other side of the wall. She still finds it difficult to get used to the thought of her only child having sex, and now carrying a baby. A baby. She can't believe she's going to be a grandmother.
She misses the sounds of San Sebastian, the occasional laughter and screeches of teenagers, the thrum of music from a neighboring tapas restaurant. The comforting noises of city life, not this god-awful silence. Then her mind wanders to Alberto. She turns onto her side and reaches for her phone on the pine bedside cabinet. It's gone midnight. Spain is an hour ahead. She expects he'll still be at the bar, the proverbial night owl. She sits up, trying to shake the image of her boyfriend surrounded by a flock of scantily clad women. There's no point lying here trying to sleep. She suffered from insomnia in the past, and all the advice she's read on the subject says to get up. She throws on her hot pink kimono and opens the bedroom door quietly so as not to wake Safi and Tom, and pads down the hallway towards the little bedroom. She's drawn to it, that bedroom, that insight into her past. She pushes the door open, wincing as it creaks, before continuing into the room. There are no curtains at the window, and a shard of moonlight illuminates a patch of black varnish stuck like tar to one of the floorboards. She stands at the window that looks over the garden. The hole in the ground looks even more ominous in the dark. The woods, thick and dense, line the back boundary. She forces her brain to remember more. "What happened here?" she whispers to her reflection. But it just stares back at her, like a ghoul with big curly hair and wide haunted eyes. She turns away from the window to survey the room. Her bed was in that corner, by the door, where the boxes are now. Yes. Yes, she remembers. It had a white iron frame and a colourful crocheted throw with large yellow daisies, and underneath she kept a pair of red patent shoes, like Dorothy's in The Wizard of Oz. She hasn't thought about those shoes for a long time. They had been her favourite. Where did they go when they moved to Bristol? And the iron bedframe and the crocheted throw? The wallpaper is faded in parts, yellowing in others. The fireplace looks like it needs renovating, and there is a thick layer of dust on the wooden mantelpiece. The past tenants obviously didn't use this room. Safi and Tom will have their work cut out if they want to turn it into a nursery. She turns back to the window. A cloud moves across the moon, so that for a few moments the woods and the garden look bleak and sinister. She should go back to bed and read. She's got Marion Keyes's new one ready to begin. She wraps her kimono further around her body. She's cold now and shivers slightly. Just as she's about to turn and leave, something bright catches her eye. A flicker of light between the trees and the woods. She presses her nose to the glass and cups her hands around her face. Her heart picks up speed. It looks like torchlight. Is someone there, watching the house? She blinks, not taking her eyes off the dot of light, the surrounding halo-like beam moving between the darkness of the trees. And then, just as quickly, it vanishes. She stands there for a further 10 minutes, straining to see. But there is nothing. The next morning, Lorna doesn't mention it to her daughter. She knows she'll only worry, and that's the last thing she wants. Instead, after she's dressed and had breakfast, one of Tom's fry-ups that she notices Safi pushes around her plate, she says she'd like to walk in the garden. "I'll come with you," says Safi, making to get up from the table. Tom already has his old decorating clothes on, saying he wants to make a start on painting the banister in the hallway. "No, it's okay. You finish your breakfast. I'll see if anything jogs my memory." "Oh, okay. Good idea." The sun is bright this morning, although there is a chill in the air and dew on the grass as Lorna steps onto the lawn, the dampness seeping into the sides of her sandals. She takes a deep breath of the unpolluted country air. It smells more refreshing this morning, like washing after it's been on the line. She ignores the hole in the ground and carries on until she reaches the end of the garden with the beautiful purple tree. She wonders what it's called. She makes a mental note to ask Safi. She turns back towards the cottage to make sure her daughter isn't watching and steps onto one of the low, thick branches, just enough to give her a leg up so she can hop over the wall. The action is so natural, she must have done it before. She holds onto the trunk for support as she jumps down on the other side. The ground there is higher, with little pathways ahead snaking through the trees, dotted with bluebells. Lorna surveys the spot where she saw the light last night. She's not sure what she's expecting to find. Footprints, perhaps? Although the ground is too dry. And then she notices something. A patch of bluebells has been flattened, as if someone recently stood on them. She moves closer, her eyes scanning the ground, and then she glimpses something else among the trampled flowers. 3 cigarette butts. She hadn't been imagining it last night. Someone had crept through the darkness and into the woods. Someone had been watching the house, watching them. Part 2.